The year is 1798. The poets William Wordsworth and Samuel Taylor Coleridge publish what was considered to be a revolutionary volume of poetry, lyrical ballads. And in lyrical ballads, the opening of the text, its advertisement, claims that it is that the poems in the volume should be read as experiments. And so part of what we get in the Wordsworth Coleridge Revolution in Poetic Language, to borrow a phrase from Julia Kristeva, is the movement towards what your editor Richter describes as expressivity, that is a movement toward expression and a movement towards a concentration on the articulation coming from the artist, and in this case the poets. So, in that revolutionary volume, of course, appears several of the major texts of English Romanticism. Certainly The Rime of the Ancient Mariner was positioned first. Wordsworth's fabulous poem Tintern Abbey is positioned deeper in the volume. But the only problem with the volume, of course, from the point of view of our critical concerns, is that it did not have, as it were, an overarching poetics. When they got the opportunity to bring out the second edition of Lyrical Ballads in 1800, Coleridge insisted that Wordsworth provide him with an introduction, and the introduction was geared to describe and interact with and intersect the theory of poetry that had preceded the Romantic Age and the poetry that is, in a sense, considered revolutionary from this particular volume. And so, in 1800, and again in 1802, Wordsworth publishes he attaches to the subsequent editions of Lyrical Ballads, a preface. And in the preface, we find perhaps the most famous definition of poetry for the Romantic Age, and that is that poetry is the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings, but, as he says much later in the preface, that it is that spontaneous overflow recollected in tranquility. It turns out that this type of revolution in poetic language is tied intimately to an attempt on Wordsworth's part to overturn Augustan poetic modes. Primarily, he said that what is poetic language? Poetic language is, in fact, the language of everyday life used in extraordinary circumstances in order to try and connect, as it were, poetic endeavors, which had been seen as high art, with a more populist approach to literary materials. As you can already tell, that this type of approach really clearly intersects what one might call the sort of revolutionary fires that are burning across the English Channel in France. And for that reason, this volume is always considered to be something of a revolutionary volume. Now, it turns out, and you'll know this from your reading of not just Wordsworth and Coleridge, but also Shelley and Keats, that there a type of split emerges between the first and second generations of poets. And I'll return to that tension in just a second, but the reason that I mention it up front is that it actually does sort of concretize a sort of problem or division that emerges from Kantian epistemology. Of course, the text from Kant that we read, that enormously difficult Critique of Judgment, wherein he elaborates our responses to the beautiful and to the sublime. But if you looked at Kant's other work, of course, he also produces a critique of practical reason and a critique of pure reason. So you can already begin to feel the tensions, as it were, between the rational mind and the imaginative mind. And, of course, we will find this theme picked up again later in the course, especially in the second half of the course when we get into critical trends. And so Wordsworth says that the best type of poetic language is the language of everyday life, tied closely to lived experience. However, his argument for the poet is precisely the place where you begin to perceive a split between, say, Wordsworth and Coleridge on the one hand, and Shelley and Keats on the other. He actually says, you know, so what is a poet? A poet is a man speaking to other men. However, he then goes on to talk about that the poet is certainly a type of exemplary man. And actually, I will go ahead and quote a little bit at length from page 307. He goes, taking up the subject then upon general grounds, I ask what is meant by the word poet. What is a poet? To whom does he address himself? And what language is to be expected from him? Here's the famous answer. He is a man speaking to men. A man, it is true, endued with more lively sensibility, more enthusiasm and tenderness, who has a greater knowledge of human nature and a more comprehensive soul than are supposed to be common among mankind. A man pleased with his own passions and volitions, and who rejoices more than other men in the spirit of life that is in him, delighting to contemplate similar volitions and passions as manifested in the ongoing of the universe, and habitually impelled to create them where he does not find them. So, even though the poet may be a man speaking to men, it turns out, in Wordsworth's definition, that the poet is, in a sense, a better man. That is, he is a man that is imbued with more a lively sensibility, enthusiasm, tenderness, knowledge of human nature, a comprehensive soul. And so here is generally the tension that one can locate in the democratic impulses of claiming that the poet is a man speaking to men, but then the somewhat regal aspects of this definition, which actually talks about, in a sense, the poet is actually a superior man. Now, the specific revolution, as it were, in poetic language is always tied, strangely enough, and this is one of the places where Wordsworth, Coleridge, Shelley, and Keats agree, and that is that the vehicle of our interaction with poetry is defined by pleasure, and of course, as you'll recall, we found that same concept embedded in Kant, and we could actually trace that same concept as far back as Horace's Ars Poetica. And again, to quote from the text for reading for last week and for Tuesday, we have no sympathy but what is propagated by pleasure. I would not be misunderstood, but wherever we sympathize with pain, it will be found that the sympathy is produced and carried on by a subtle combination of pleasure. And so for him, and also for the poet, it turns out, as he says a little farther down that line, quote, his knowledge is pleasure. He considers man and the objects that surround him as acting and reacting upon each other so as to produce an infinite complexity of pain and pleasure. Well, you can already hear in the use of the terms pain and pleasure the penetration into English criticism of the sort of Kantian categories and, you know, the sort of primary effects of an encounter with the beautiful and an encounter with the sublime. Of course, as we know, the encounter with the beautiful generates certainly pleasure. The encounter with the sublime certainly does generate a type of fear, but that fear itself also then, in a sense, is referenced to pleasure as well. Almost immediately following the definitions of what is poetry and following the definitions of what is the poet, Wordsworth returns to the notion of just what precisely a poet is and what is poetry. As he says on page 309 of your text, poetry is the breath and finer spirit of all knowledge. It is the impassioned expression which is in the countenance of all sciences. Believe me, we're going to hear a similar statement to that statement once we read or once we take the plunge and Shelley. Now, he goes on that same page to say that poetry is the first and last of all knowledge. It is as immortal as the heart of man. If the labors of men of science should ever create any material revolution, direct or indirect, in our condition and in the impressions with with which we have habitually received, the poet will sleep then no more than at present, but he will be ready to follow the steps of the man of science, not only general indirect effects, but he will be at his side carrying sensation into the midst of the objects of science itself. So, for Wordsworth here, it turns out that poetry is something that encompasses all of science, and, of course, the claim is that if the men of science actually evoke a revolution, then the poet would follow them as well. Well, of course, in across the disciplines of knowledge, that type of revolution is precisely happening at the time that Wordsworth is writing. Geology is revolutionized by James Hutton's theory of the Earth. Shortly thereafter, geology is further revolutionized in the work of Charles Lyell, which is so important to Charles Darwin in the establishment of evolutionary theory. Now, the and yet, we will hear again something, we will hear this sort of expression of the relationship of literature and science, of poet and scientist. We'll hear that echoed again when we turn to The Defense of Poetry by Shelley. Now, as we move across, as it were, the preface to Lyrical Ballads, I notice that on page 310, of course, this is where he makes his chief distinction. He says, the sum of what I have said is that the poet is chiefly distinguished from other men by a greater promptness to think and feel without immediate external citation, and a greater power in expressing his thoughts and feelings as are produced in him in that manner. So it turns out that you can sort of now tell the difference between, say, the type of mimetic theory of representation that we have encountered in both Plato and in Aristotle, and have come forward through Sir Philip Sidney. But we now, in a sense, have a moment where what is being, in a sense, represented is not nature in and of itself, but in fact the nature of sensations as they are felt by both the poet and by those that consume and read poetry as well. Now, shortly thereafter, Wordsworth actually then provides us with the definition of poetry that I led with, as it were, in this lecture. I have said, this is on your page 312, I have said that poetry is the spontaneous overflow of powerful feeling. It takes its origin from emotion recollected in tranquility. The emotion is contemplated till, by a species of reaction, the tranquility gradually disappears, and an emotion, kindred to that which was before the subject of contemplation, is gradually produced and does itself actually exist in the mind. And so the emphasis on the mind here points to the primary complaint that both Shelley and Keats are going to mount relative to Wordsworth, and that is that every time that, for example, if you're reading a Wordsworth poem, you begin with nature, and of course we tend to think of Wordsworth as a nature poet, but we begin with nature, but usually within 10 to 15 lines, what begins as nature poetry always comes back and makes reference to Wordsworth's mind. Now, this shouldn't surprise us, because after all, his major epic effort, as it were, was called The Prelude, and what's more important is what comes after the colon. It's The Prelude, or The Growth of the Poet's Mind. And so he is very much focused on how his individual mind meets that general nature that exists outside of the self. And for this reason, in one of his letters, John Keats, as you'll recall, actually describes, when he's talking about the poet, he describes Wordsworth as being a poet. I think he actually uses the phrase, you know, the egotistical or Wordsworthian sublime. And what he means by that is that when you're reading Wordsworth's poetry, what seems to mask itself is nature poetry, actually is poetry about the self. And for that reason, Keats sort of just sort of disdains, as it were, this sort of egotistical mode that he associates so clearly with Wordsworth. Actually, for Keats, in one of his relatively famous letters, he actually goes on to mount the argument that, you know, the poet, and I'm going to be quoting this more or less from memory, that the poet is a most unpoetical of all creatures. That is, a poet, from the Keatsian point of view, has no identity whatsoever. That is, to phrase it differently, the poet, unlike Wordsworth, who, when he's reading nature, in a sense, he moves outward in order to describe the natural scene, but ultimately that natural description ultimately flows back and makes reference to the self. The Keatsian mode, and I think this is one that's certainly shared by Shelley as well, the Keatsian mode tends to be more that the poet pursues a type of self-emptying, or what William Blake would call a type of self-annihilation, in which the discrete identity of the poet is lost as the poet projects himself forward and enters into the subject of his reflections. For example, one of his more famous poems is the Ode to the Nightingale. Second favorite ode is something like Ode to a Grecian Urn. And in both cases, this is what we see in the poetic voice of those poems, is that, you know, the poet loses identity and then merges with an object outside of the self, and it lifts, or uplifts, as it were, poetic consciousness into a type of fusion or emergence with whatever is being made referred to in exteriority. Nature on the one hand via something like the Nightingale, or culture on the other hand, relative to a Grecian urn. We already have a sense now of what is going to define something of the tensions between the first and the second generations of these romantic thinkers. When we turn actually to Coleridge, the thing that you probably will have noted from your introduction, which is on page 315 to 317, is that primarily Coleridge was responsible for the emergence of Kant, as it were, into English. Coleridge always considered himself a metaphysician, and so he became intimately bound up with the type of critical pronouncements that are flowing from Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, and then later, what we've read in this class, which is the third critique, which is the Critique of Judgment. Now, for Coleridge, Coleridge has provided criticism with some of its more salient features, and these are usually sort of floating in different sections of Biographia Literaria. And I will be moving to them shortly, but I would only like to pick up a couple of points, as it were, from Kant as they meet Coleridge, and that is primarily, for Kant and for Coleridge alike, the external world consists of what he calls noumena, things whose existence we have to assume but about which we can form no clear idea. And of course, it's noumena and then ultimately phenomena, because you can hear the root of the term there. And he also operates out of a type of categorical thinking, that is, that he tends to, in a sense, run the gauntlet of the categories of understanding that are marked out by quality, quantity, substance, and relation. And so the noumena enters the mind, what emerges from the mind is phenomena. As a result of this type of move, the world as it appears to us is, in a sense, half-created, half-experienced. Now, this is a type of trope that we find quite often in some of Coleridge's best poetry, and I'm thinking of the Aeolian Harp on the one hand and Dejection and Ode on the other. And so part of what these thinkers are interested in doing is rehealing the fissure, as it were, that emerged between mind on the one hand and matter on the other. That is, they're committed to what I would term a holistic view, or, you know, what, to use poetic language from the period, an active universe in which mind participates equally in the construction of what we would call reality. Now, when we turn from sort of pure philosophy, as it were, to Coleridge's most important insights, and the most often quoted sections of something like Biographia Literaria, we arrive immediately at chapter 13 of Biographia Literaria, where he argues that the primary imagination I hold to be the living power and prime agent of all human perception, and as a repetition in the finite mind of the eternal act of creation in the infinite I am. So, in a sense, he associates the primary imagination with what one might call a sort of primal power that in a sense models or echoes, as it were, the infinite power of creation. So here we can actually see that Coleridge is not terribly distant from some of the thoughts that are flowing in Sydney initially, but also that flow across and especially put in a major appearance in Kant's Critique at the tail end of our reading. So the primary imagination is responsible for perception. So what does the secondary imagination do for Coleridge? The secondary imagination is responsible for art. And so we get a type of tripartite division in chapter 13, which is relatively short, certainly in your book, and that is that we have primary imagination and primary and secondary imaginations. He calls the secondary as an echo of the primary, and so as a result, unlike the primary imagination, the power of secondary imagination varies from individual to individual. The third element, which is now a fairly degraded element, and I would ask you to recall my mapping, as it were, of the role that imagination plays initially in a writer like John Locke, and how we have gone through a series of transmutations so that the imagination has moved from being simply a mechanical function of mind and recombination of discrete ideas into something grander. That is, it turns out that for almost all of these thinkers, the imagination itself is aligned with the divine, and as a result, it becomes the primary attribute of you know, sort of creative consciousness. Now, the third term here, and it occurs at the end. May seem odd to us these days, because he actually says that, you know, that fancy is an inferior activity because it operates entirely within the sort of normal perceptual world. As a result, it is much more mechanical in its function than the type of free play that the primary and secondary imagination events or evidence. Now. Of course, the other great phrase that Coleridge has given us is this notion that, and so what is art? Art is a type of what he calls a defamiliarization. And this is something that he talks about in his critique of Wordsworth in Biographia Literaria, when he's actually talking about how they cut up their tasks for the revolutionary volume with which I began this novel. With this lecture. I hope it's not a novel. I am assuming you probably would sort of go to sleep if it were. Basically, he said that the point of their attempt was that for Wordsworth was going to pursue what he would call the poetry of nature, whereas Coleridge is going to pursue supernatural subjects. And so when he moves to actually talk about the supernatural, which is going to be his endeavor following his discussion of Wordsworth's attempt to try and pull poetic material from what he calls the real and from scenes, quote, chosen from ordinary life. But when he turns to his endeavor, of course, and I'm on your page 322 on this, he goes on to say, in this idea originated the plan of lyrical ballads, in which it was agreed that my endeavor should be directed to persons and characters supernatural, or at least romantic, yet so as to transfer from our inward nature a human interest and a semblance of truth sufficient to procure from these shadows of imagination that, and now the most important phrase, that willing suspension of disbelief for the moment which constitutes poetic faith. And so what we gain here in this section is a couple of cardinal points that have actually been mainstays of criticism ever since, and that is part of what poetry and to a large extent part of what art does is that it takes the familiar and it defamiliarizes it, and by defamiliarizing it adds an intensity and also restores a type of, oh, I don't know, for lack of a better word, perhaps intensity and perhaps mystery, the return of a type of mystery, and of course, and it's out of that mystery that, of course, Coleridge constitutes his, quote, poetic faith, end quote. Now, against this view, when we turn to Shelley, part of what we find is that here is again somebody that has had his faculties roused to action, so to speak, to borrow a phrase from William Blake, because a friend of his, a guy named Thomas Love Peacock, with his tongue firmly implanted in his cheek, published something called The Four Ages of Poetry, in which, to run roughshod over that document, it goes something like this. Poetry and all literature begins in an age of an age of iron, an age of iron, in which, it's primarily heroic epic material, and I always tend to think of Beowulf, for example, as the apt example of this. Following Beowulf, you get a type of flowering of English literature that we call the English Renaissance. And that English Renaissance period is always defined as the Golden Age. So the Second Age is an age of gold. The Third Age, the Age of Silver, follows immediately upon the gold, and if we're thinking in English literary traditions, one might very well think of, say, the Augustan poets, somebody like Alexander Pope, who writes polished verse, but is primarily a slave, if you'll allow me the phrase, to form itself, because form dictated meaning during the Augustan period, and that becomes the Augustan mode. And so finally Peacock arrives at the current age, and this is where I think you could probably see his tongue planted about as far in his cheek as he could get it. That is, and so what does this leave the age, the current age, the age in which Wordsworth and Coleridge and Keats and Shelley and Byron are writing? It becomes the age of brass, BRASS. And it's an age where the integrity and intensity of poetry has simply collapsed. Now, like I said, this was published as a sort of wry, a wry and sort of provocative document. However, Shelley, it roused Shelley's highest acts of criticism, it turns out, because he then, in A Defense of Poetry, not only decides to refute his friend Thomas Love Peacock, but he also decides to extend the type of arguments that we have already seen and grappled with in looking at Sir Philip Sidney's A Defense of Poesy. For Shelley, poetry in a general sense may be defined to be the expression of the imagination, and poetry is connate with the origin of man. I'm reading from your page 340. He then goes to talk about the origins of the sort of poetic sensibility. He goes on to say on that same page, 340, in the youth of the world, men dance and sing and imitate natural objects, observing in these actions, as in all others, a certain order or rhythm. And then he actually goes on shortly later to assert, for there is a certain order or rhythm belonging to each of these classes of mimetic representation. And so the return of the mimetic is certainly something that comes through with Shelley, and is put under a type of erasure, as it were, with Wordsworth and Coleridge. Now, this type of argument where in the infancy, I'm on your page 340, in the infancy of society, every author is necessarily a poet because language itself is poetry, and to be a poet is to apprehend the true and the beautiful, in a word, the good, which exists in the relation subsisting first between existence and perception, and secondly between perception and expression. Now, in these two passages that I've just talked about, Shelley actually ends up being quite close to a rather provocative, innovative, and wild thinker from the end of the 19th century, Friedrich Nietzsche. And the type of sentiments that I've just read for Shelley certainly clearly intersects, it seems to me, the type of language that one finds in The Birth of Poetry, The Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music. It turns out that was Nietzsche's first major publication. So we already have, as it were, a sort of forerunner of the type of provocative break with classical epistemology that one finds in Nietzsche. You can find in an incipient form, so to speak, in Shelley's A Defense of Poetry. Now, as he turns, of course, part of what he wants to articulate here as well is his seeming opposition to the Wordsworthian mode. And so for Wordsworth, of course, the emphasis was always on the sort of language of everyday life, the sort of plain and ordinary language that's tied directly to nature, and it turns out that, of course, even Coleridge has trouble with this particular type of construction, as undoubtedly you noticed in chapter 17 of Biographia Literaria, which is across your page 325 through 328, I believe. Let me just take a peek here. Actually, even farther than that. And so he actually chides Wordsworth with this desire to try and embody a type of language, mainly because, Coleridge knows, and Wordsworth has decided not to sort of theorize, but Coleridge knows that language is, in fact, an arbitrary vehicle of communication. And that's precisely what where Shelley is going to go in his sort of first attack. But before he gets there, and again, I'm on your page 341, he actually then builds a bridge between his arguments and those arguments that are offered by Sir Philip Sidney. I'm on 341, first column, down below. All original religions are allegorical or susceptible to allegory, and like Janus, have a double face or of false and true. Poets, according to the circumstances of the age and nation in which they appeared, were called in the earlier epochs of the world legislators or prophets. A poet essentially comprises and unites both of these characters, and I'm just skipping a few lines here. Not that I assert poets to be prophets in the gross sense of the word, or that they can foretell the form as surely as they foreknow the spirit of events. Such is the pretense of superstition, which would make poetry an attribute of prophecy rather than prophecy an attribute of poetry. Now, this last statement, actually, although we haven't read him, it's a statement that comes fairly close to sentiments that William Blake expresses in a rather provocative document called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which I suspect many of you have read before or encountered before, certainly in courses like English 222. The notion is that when a poet argues the line of prophecy, they're not arguing the line of prognostication, that is, that they predict the future, so much as they are keen readers of what I would call the historical landscape, and as such, they are able to say, and now I'll borrow Blake's words, if things continue in a certain way, this is what's going to happen, which is different because that's a cause-effect argument, which is different than saying, hey, I had a vision and this is what was going to happen and it's going to be the end of the world. So Shelley now is going to, following his sort of solidification of his connections with Sir Philip Sidney and then actually all the way back to the prophetic traditions that exist in both Greece and in Hebraic culture, he then makes a grand claim for the poet, but one that, notice, he's already said that, you know, at the beginning of the world, everyone was a poet, and so we all have this quality that resides within us. A poet, again, I'm on page 341, a poet participates in the eternal, the infinite, and the one. As far as relates to his conceptions, time and space and number are not. Now, here we are extremely close, it seems to me, to the position that John Keats takes when he talks about the poet having, in a sense, no identity. And just give me a second, because I would like to go ahead and flip over to that particular passage. You'll just have to give me just one second. I thought I had it marked here. Sorry about that. This is my inaugural run doing this sort of thing. It turns out that one of John Keats's major points is as to the poetical character itself. I mean, he's going to talk about poetical character first and the poet second. As to the poetical character itself, I mean that sort of which, if I am anything, I am a member, that sort distinguished from the Wordsworthian or egotistical sublime, which is a thing per se and stands alone. And so to now jump over, as it were, the parenthetical, as to poetical character itself, it is not itself. It has no self. It is everything and nothing. It has no character. It enjoys light and shade. It lives in gusto, be it foul or fair, high or low, rich or poor, mean or elevated. It has as much delight in conceiving an Iago, of course, the character from Shakespeare's famous character from Othello, as of an Imogen. And Imogen is the virtuous heroine of Cymbeline. Now, he goes on in this same letter, and notice that the majority of all of Keats's critical statements come in letters written to various people, sometimes his relatives, sometimes others. Now, he goes on to say, a poet is the most unpoetical of anything in existence because he has no identity. He is continually in for and filling some other body, the sun, the moon, the sea, and men and women who are creatures of impulse, of impulse are poetical and have about them an unchangeable attitude. The poet has none, no identity. He is certainly the most unpoetical of all God's creatures. So so you can already see the linkage that is now being forged between these second generation poets as they begin to try and mount the argument to overturn the sort of Wordsworthian mode. On this same page, 341, where I was just reading from Shelley, Shelley makes it explicit. He says, for language is arbitrarily produced by the imagination and has relation to thoughts alone. But all other materials, instruments, and conditions of art have relations among each other, which limit and interpose between conception and expression. The former is a mirror which reflects, the latter as a cloud which enfeebles, the light of which both are mediums of communication. And so, what we hear in this notion that language is arbitrary, you have an implied critique of the type of privileging of a certain type of language that we find in Wordsworth, and of course, as I mentioned earlier, you can see a similar critique even from Coleridge as well in chapter 17 and following of Biographia Literaria. So, following this sort of epiphany, as it were, then we get a series of assertions about just what is poetry and what is a poem. On page 342, second column down below, a poem is the very image of life expressed in eternal truth. Well, here we have the very good reason for returning poets to the Republic, because they are no longer speakers of falsehoods and no longer representers of third reflected material or thrice reflected material. A poem now expresses eternal truth. And poetry, I'm just over to the next page, not very far, poetry is ever accompanied with pleasure. Now here is a point where, in fact, every single romantic theorist agrees, and that is that poetry is ever accompanied with pleasure. All spirits on which it falls open themselves to receive the wisdom which is mingled with its delight. And so, the whole object, and now I've jumped over to page 344, of the immortality of poetry, the immorality of poetry rests upon a misconception of the manner in which poetry acts to produce the moral improvement of man. And so, it turns out that, again, against the assertions of Plato, it turns out that poetry acts in another and diviner manner than that had been that which had been presupposed. It awakens and enlarges the mind itself by rendering it the receptacle of 1,000 unapprehended combinations of thought. And now poetry also, even as it provides an element of, or returns an element of mystery to the world, it also, poetry lifts the veil from the hidden beauty of the world and makes familiar objects be as if they were not familiar. There's that element of defamiliarization that we have already pulled in from Coleridge. It reproduces all that it represents, and the impersonations clothed in its Elysian light stand thenceforth in the minds of those who have once contemplated them as memorials of that gentle and exalted content which extends itself over all thoughts and actions with which it coexists. Poetry enlarges the circumference of the imagination. Poetry strengthens the faculty, which is the organ of the moral nature of man. A poet, therefore, would do ill to embody his own conceptions of right and wrong, which are usually those of his place and time, in his poetic creations, which participate in neither. Why? Because they participate in the eternal... they participate in the eternal, the active, the one, and the one is truth. And so, it turns out, Plato was wrong. It turns out that poetry is the primary vehicle of apprehension of truth in the world, and for Shelley, the ignition point for that ethos is, in fact, the stimulation of the expression of love. As he says on page 344, the great secret of morals is love, or a going out of our own nature and an identification of ourselves with the beautiful which exists in thought, action, or person, not our own. And so, for Shelley, like for Keats, poetry is, in a sense, hinged to, that is, the ethical dimension of poetry is always hinged to our ability to move out of ourself and, as a result, through identification, move into connection with others, as opposed to the Wordsworthian mode, which tends to leave us always, returns us always, in isolation to the Wordsworthian mind as it contemplates how the mind itself interacts with matter. Now, when he says, and of course he actually says this a little further on page 347, poetry ever communicates all the pleasure which men are capable of receiving. It is ever still the light of life, the source of whatever of beautiful or generous or true can have place in an evil time. And so, in spite of their differences, here is this concept of pleasure is something that actually then flows across the entire history of criticism, with getting of course, differing emphases in different periods of time. And, of course, just to sort of move away from the sort of formal aspect of the lecture, I would say that that element of pleasure in its critical guise is something that I think actually does have a type of relevance to the hypertextual environment within which this class is operating, and as a result, It seems to me that one possible element that we can bring to our consideration of actually not our consider but our entry into that hypertextual environment. Now, Shelley, as he moves to, of course, the tail end of this sort of unbelievably wonderful work, I mean, I must confess it's one of my favorites in the history of criticism, mainly because, of course, it's, A, talking about poetry, and you all know by now my my bias in that direction. But, again, on page 353, as he's returning in order to provide a summation, poetry is indeed something divine. It is at once the center and circumference of knowledge. It is that which comprehends all science and that to which all science must be referred. Now, that means that poetry is, and I'm just moved to the next page, poetry is the record of the of best and happiest moments of the happiest and best minds, and so therefore poetry thus makes immortal all that is best and most beautiful in the world. Now, when, and that was all, those are both quotes from page 354. Of course, now, for Shelley, it sort of seems sort of somewhat interesting that for Shelley, of course, you can be a poet without necessarily writing poetry. I mean, keep in mind where he actually identifies and articulates the origins of that prophetic moment in an act of imitation of nature. But, you know, as you move across time, that is, there are people that write prose that fit very clearly into Shelley's definition of a poet. A poet, as he is the author of author to others of the highest wisdom, pleasure, virtue, and glory, so he ought personally to be the happiest, the best, the wisest, and the most illustrious of men. Of course, needless to say, that doesn't happen certainly for Shelley, and certainly doesn't happen for almost all the poets that I can think of. However, what Shelley is starting to argue is that it is poetry, and notice that he actually associates somebody like Tasso or Lord Bacon as being a poet, somebody like Spencer or Lord Bacon as being a poet, that you don't have to necessarily write poetry in order to be a poet, because what is it that poets are? This is where the essay ends on page 356. Poets are the hierophants of an unapprehended inspiration, the mirrors of the gigantic shadows which futurity casts upon the present, the words which express what they understand not, the trumpets which sing to battle and feel not what they inspire, the influence which is moved not but moves. And now the grand assertion, poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. Why is that? Because, in fact, they are the primary vehicles of unveiling truth in the world. And, of course, all of these works are written in a revolutionary age. Now, in order to close off, I don't want to go too much longer. I think I've probably have sort of abused your good nature enough at this point. But I would ask you to sort of, in a sense, now see how the type of spirit that Kant is talking about, and of course he's talking about that on page 277 and 278 of your text, that spirit, that animating principle of mind, for Shelley, I mean, he adopts that and embraces that view, but of course for Shelley, it is also that that spirit within meets the type of spirit of the age, to use an oft-quoted phrase from William Hazlitt. And so, how does this occur? The poet has a certain order or rhythm that is expressed in the very physical nature of his body and in the physical manifestation of mind. And that certain order or rhythm within actually meets the type of order or rhythm that exists outside of the self as well. And so what you get is a type of participation between mental powers on the one hand and material manifestation and powers on the other. And so for Shelley, who is probably the most intriguing thinker, I would argue, of all these people, that that point of connection, that rhythm itself as a poetic vehicle is also a philosophical vehicle, because in fact it is the rhythm within and the rhythm without that coalesces in order to, as it were, define the nature of reality itself. And so, as many of these poets say, and certainly Shelley is one of them, reality is half perceived, half felt. Anyway, well, I know that we have Hegel coming up, and so I will try and work some of this material into Hegel today. I would certainly also say that, you know, I apologize for, you know, the sort of weird intrusions that came this week that didn't allow me to get this lecture done until now. And so, of course, obviously, I don't expect you to, you know, to have listened to this before we actually get to class today. But I would just generally request that for you to listen to it at some point over the weekend, and then contemplate how this type of material that you've read intersects and interacts with the sort of high German romantic criticism that we're getting first from Kant, and then, of course, from Kant's student, Hegel. Anyway, thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you later. I'll see you this afternoon. Bye-bye.